David, I can't believe it's taken us 5 years to finally win an award. But now we have. It's time to implement the original master plan.
Sell out to sponsors?
Yes! And that's why we've obviously chosen our natural sponsor, an online food takeaway service. Thanks, Food Hub. Those lovely people at Food Hub have given us all the takeaways we want so we can make you fat by downloading the Food Hub app. Right now, David and I are sat in a bathtub of Vindaloo.
With some spicy meatballs. Unlike other services, Food Hub supports independent and not charging a commission to the restaurant. This means buying from Food Hub is on average 15% cheaper than its rival with the same meal.
And there's no service charge added to your bill, like those other thieving bastards like to do.
So download the Food Hub app for exclusive offers and deals from participating restaurants and get 15% off your first order with the code FYB15. Bad
Bad
boys,
boys,
bad
bad
boys.
boys.
What
What
you
you
gonna
gonna
do?
do?
You're gonna download the Food Hub app.
They're bad. They're boys. And occasionally they talk about running. Yes, it's the Bad Boy Running Podcast with your hosts, Jody Rainsford and David Heller.
Come back. Baby, come back.
With a bye 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 bye. With a bye 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 bye. I must admit I was a clone to be messing around. But that doesn't mean that you have to leave town. Come
A bye bye bye
Bye
bye
bye
bye
bye
bye bye bye
bye
bye
bye
bye
bye bye.
Hello, welcome to Bad Boy Running. Hello, Jenny Rainsford.
Hello, how are you?
Yes, I am good. I'm excited about today's guest because not often we get someone who we can have as a guest for about four or five different topics. But if you don't know who Greg Vallée is, he is the man who essentially runs all of the athletes, organized all the athletes for Solomon, the sponsorships. He's set that team up. He's taken running to trail running. He's brought it to places like China, to Nepal. He's taking it into all these new countries. Just a really interesting guy. Very good athlete as well. And we didn't even pay any respect to that at all. We just completely ignored that.
We did, but we did credit him with pretty much inventing trailing. So I think that's a pretty good
Off
payoff.
balance. Yeah, we don't know if you're any good, but I can't believe people didn't run before you came along, Greg.
The thing is, if I was taking trail running to all these other countries, I'd pretend I was the inventor of it. Hey, I've invented this concept. It's basically you running on the only thing that you could run on anyway, but doing it for fun.
So that is what you've got to look forward to, listener. Now, we were going to be making an announcement of a big landmark in our listenership. Do you remember this, Jody?
Yes, I do. This is amazing.
So we get rough stats on who's listening from where, for which episode, and it's always very hard with a podcast to know actually what is a relevant stat. And what is useful, what you can take as being fact, because you never know who's downloaded it, who's listened to it, how many times. And so they try and create stats that gives you some kind of information. So we're quite excited because we had been coming up to the millionth episode for a while, and
Millionth episode? Millionth episode?
we're still coming up to it for quite a while. Yeah, we're doing the 900,000 days of Christmas special. Really, once a minute,
It
once a
felt
minute.
like it. It felt like it for the listener and for us. But that's the thing, is it was supposed to be like nine, like what, million downloads. But it's the thing is, it is a weird one because it's like a million downloads or a million listens or a million full listens of an episode or a million start listens. So there's so many different stats which are completely meaningless, but we were coming up to this landmark, and we'd been prepping this landmark for a while.
And that's the thing, we thought, this is quite exciting to celebrate our millionth. And then when we actually went to look at our stats, trying to figure out, what's actually going on here?
We need to back up a bit here, because I think I'm going to be completely honest with the listeners. We were kind of going, why don't we have more listeners? When we looked at the stats, it seemed like people like our subscribers and our listeners on iTunes were going down, and like we weren't getting any subscribers anywhere else. We're like, it doesn't match up with everything else that's happening. Like the community.
Yeah, we walked down the street and people are like applauding us. We can't go anywhere with people buying us coffees and just thanking us, you know, tears in their eyes.
That doesn't happen to me.
Oh, maybe you need to get up to Newcastle. Go and see our friends up there. They'll be supporting us. Tynebridge, you know what I'm talking about. But it turns out that we, for the past year, have been missing between 40 and 60% of our stats.
And it's not our fault. It's not our fault. That's the thing. Of all the balls ups that ever happened, this is not our fault. This is a Spotify reporting issue that David managed to identify.
So we may be now, well, we're definitely over a million, but who knows, maybe we're at a billion. Maybe. So thanks, listeners, for listening in, because at least a million of you have listened a million times, or I don't know, something like that, episodes, something along those lines, and we find that quite exciting. So
it's really interesting because for ages and ages we're thinking, right, I just don't understand. You know, we put out really long episodes, we get a lot of listeners, but we don't seem to be, you know, we seem to be in the charts. We seem to be like behind things. You're like, God, that's really niche. Like,
we weren't even in the charts. We weren't in the top 200, and now we're number one.
Because majority of our listeners are on Spotify, I don't know, you probably listen to this on Spotify, and it wasn't reporting the Spotify stats.
We didn't even tag ourselves as running either. That's a new category. We were just down as health and fitness, and yeah, I mean. But anyway.
That's because we had that problem of being a pioneer. We pioneered the running podcast, and at the time when we pioneered it, they didn't have running as an option, as an individual category. You had to go into health and fitness or sport. And then the popularity of the running category, you know, meant that it was created. But we didn't keep up with our metadata because we got better things to do.
Actually, talking about keeping up with the times.
I'm actually talking about metadata. I'm like, let's not.
Now, you're obviously a very hip man, aren't you, Rainsford?
It wouldn't surprise me if I need a hip replacement soon. Hip is not a word that has ever been used in relation.
I thought you needed a hip replacement after repeated use. Surely that's one thing you're not in danger of. But have you ever heard of the hipster index?
The hipster index. That sounds like something from. It sounds like a bar in Brighton.
Well, interesting you say that. A property company in the States has come up with an index of how hip a place is. And they've looked at most places, big cities in the world. Now, they've taken how many people live there.
Yeah.
And they've also looked at the number of vegan eateries, coffee shops, tattoo studios, vintage boutiques and record stores per 100,000 people. Number one in the world, home of Jody Rainsford, Brighton and Hove.
Of course it is. Of course it is. Brighton's woke central. Like, it could. Do you know, describing all those things pretty much makes up like 90% of Brighton. You walk around Brighton, you're like, I have literally no idea how any of these businesses are functioning. That wouldn't surprise me at all.
Yeah,
so I think you'll find I'm like the 3% that isn't hip of that.
So the crazy thing about this is, on the hipster scale, they're an 8.1632, 8.1631 is Portland in the US.
Oh, is it?
So they're one shop away from becoming hipper than Brighton and Hove.
And they've got vampires.
Do they?
Yeah, isn't that where Lost Boys was filmed? Portland, Oregon.
Is it? No way.
I'm sure it was. Is it Portland, Oregon? Wait a minute. The reason they're so hip is because they've got all those BLM riots. That makes them they're hip at the moment because they're part of the hip zeitgeist. But they've got to be careful.
Too many riots, and they're going to have to close down some of those businesses, and they're going to be dropping out of that top 10.
See, the thing is, in Brighton, Brighton's too hip to do that kind of a violent protest. I remember, did I tell you the time when I got caught up in an Extinction Rebellion protest? Casually. This was it. I didn't even realise I was part of this Extinction Rebellion protest, because I was just casually walking down the street, and it wasn't big enough to actually seem like it was a protest. It wasn't loud enough to seem like it was a protest. It was one of those ones where you kind of mingled in. You're like, all of a sudden, you're like, oh, I seem to be in the middle of something, but you didn't really realise at the time. And I know I talk about hating like fucking hippies and shit like that, but I was on my way to to What the Pitta.
Classic Brighton.
And pretty much all these protesters, it was like talking about, you know, destroying, like, it's called these corporate chains and stuff like that. Half of them piled into there to have their pitters as well and their cans of Coke.
Well, of course they did. I mean, there's too many good food places to do a...
They don't want to smash it. It's the most genteel. It's the most genteel type of protest in Brighton. There's never like any violence or anything, because they just, you know, it's the thing is, if there was violence, if they did smash stuff up, you wouldn't be able to tell because the place is a bloody tip already.
But that's cool. That's cool.
It's cool.
There is a new shop that is open.
Is Winchester on there?
Oh, no chance. I mean, Winchester. And London's something like 3,000th.
Surely you shouldn't call it. Surely London as a whole should be. Surely that they should actually go by borough by. What's it called? Borough by borough. Surely.
Yeah. Yeah. So, somewhere sense, like.
Wouldn't it? Like Camden.
Somewhere like Shoreditch would be, or Hoxton. Yeah. But have you ever heard of a shoe cleaning company?
What?
So this has opened on the corner.
What, you're gonna tell me that Mo Farah is their new face of shoe cleaning for them?
He needs the money. He needs the. But on the very corner at the end of my road, there's a new shop called Vamp Sneaker Cleaning, and they clean trainers for you up to £75 per pair. If you want same day cleaning.
Sorry, they charge £75.
Yeah.
What?
I've not been in. I've looked in, and it is as bizarre as it sounds. There's rows of trainers that have been or are being cleaned. And I don't know whether this is unique to Brixton or whether maybe this is a common thing in a different society I'm not used to, but I don't understand. Like, how if you're spending £75 on a pair of trainers to be cleaned, like, how much are those trainers to be worth cleaning rather than buying a new one?
Yeah, exactly. Maybe if you want to clean your Cyclone trainers. Which you'll end up paying about £300 a pair for.
Yeah, I mean, I'm almost tempted to go in with a proper pair of kind of innovate mug claws at the end of a busy trail race, just to see if they'll clean those and what kind of finish it'll be like. But as do that, email us, let us at Bad Boy.
This is all it does is just cleaning trainers.
It only cleans trainers. You can't buy, and maybe they sell trainer cleaning equipment as well, but you can't. And it's got five reviews. It says the service is on point. Received my sneakers like brand new and on time too.
Who uses the term sneakers?
Hipsters.
Sneakers?
Yeah.
What the fuck? Are we in Sesame Street? Like, what?
Yeah. Well, is this something that happens elsewhere? I've heard in the States there's a big market for reselling Nikes. And I can understand that if they're Air Jordans or really old trainers. But even those, I can't imagine people would actually wear a pair of trainers that are worth that much, because it's almost like using a stamp. You need it mint. And so I don't understand where the middle ground is, where people are taking out trainers that are worth so much money, but that they're prepared to ruin them, but they'd also then want to clean them. So, yeah. Have you heard of this? Do you know of this? Is this just a Brixton phenomenon, or is this fairly typical? Now, have you seen Killian is going for a 24-hour record? He's doing a track run.
He wants to see how fast he is on the flat.
Do you think he'll break the world record?
I love the fact that Killian just turns his mind to something that other people have been doing, and we immediately go, is he going to break the world record? Is he going to break the long stare? It's just his reputation now is such that you just, the assumption, the default position is he going to beat the world record?
Well, I think with ultras, there is an extent that really good people haven't tested the really big miles for a long time. If you compare the speed, like Killian is genuinely fast at all distances.
Yeah, so but for that particular one, 24, it's 24 hour on the track, isn't it?
Yeah.
That has been tested. That's really been tested, isn't it?
Yeah, it's been tested. And Zach, who has a current record, is a very, very good runner. But is he a sub 30 10K runner? And that's the thing. We're still seeing the progression of the sport, in that it used to be people did ultras who probably weren't quick enough to win shorter distances. Now we're getting people who are quick enough winning at shorter distances moving up. And so it'll be really interesting, because he's certainly faster runner, and he's obviously got that experience of endurance, but whether or not he can actually keep it together. You'd expect so, but
I think he'll hate it. I think as an experience for him, it'll be awful. It must be awful when anyone that goes from running, like you say, like 100-mile sort of ultras and stuff, those kind of longer distances normally take place over incredibly, normally hilly. You normally pair them up with a lot of elevation, hills, because it makes it over 100 mile, or 24 hours or whatever it is. That's what helps you mentally, breaks it up, it allows you to walk for a bit, slow down, use some gravity, things like that. And then when you do a flat one, it's like, this is awful. Like this is monotonous, this is constant. But like you said, him doing that at speed, I think he will. Yeah, I think he's gonna come really, really close. I don't think he's gonna struggle that much at all.
Part of me hopes he doesn't, because I think it would just be quite sad if he does suddenly break the record, and without much practice, without it. Hopefully he won't, because I think it's nicer to have variety in who holds the records at different distances. But interestingly enough, Nike were banned, the Vaporfly were banned from track ultras, because they came under the rules of World Athletics, I believe. So while you could run in the Vaporfly when you were doing a road 100 miler, you weren't allowed to do that if you were on the track, which obviously was a big disadvantage compared to if you were allowed to wear them. And we talked a few months ago about the first person to not have a record. I think there's a Norwegian runner who set the world record for 10 miles on a track, and he'd worn a Vaporfly or an equivalent and therefore wasn't allowed the record. They've now changed that ruling. So Camille, I don't know whether it'll be interesting actually to see what trainers he wears, because he's not a Nike runner, but there's such a huge advantage to wearing that style of trainer. And I don't think Solomon have any that he can wear that are designed for track racing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good point. That's a really good point.
So what's he going to do? And if we'd have known about this in advance of interviewing our guests, we could have asked him, like, what do you think?
Yeah,
what would you advise?
How are you going to step up? Yeah, exactly. That's really good. It's a really good point.
And would they expect him to wear?
Yeah, I mean, like, having had that discussion, it feels like they're quite flexible. It comes across as quite flexible as to the athlete's needs. Salomon is a trail thing. Yeah, like, it's not. I don't think, you know, if you said to like Killian, you go off and wear the like Vaporflies for a track thing, I don't think that in any way diminishes the Salomon brand, because it's, you know, they are so associated with trail that it doesn't impact them. It doesn't feel like it would impact them.
Can almost see it as a different sport, can't you?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's like wearing, you know, fucking like football studs to go and play football, or, you know, just, you know, something completely different in order to be able to do it. I'll tell you one person, though, that would break the world record if they did 24 hours on a track. CFTB, hashtag formality. Formality.
Yeah, without doubt. Without doubt. He'd probably find a 300 meter track.
When is he doing his 100 miler that is going to be a formality? Was that the one that was
hopefully in May? I think it's the Thames Path 100.
Oh, it's the Thames Path.
We'll see if he breaks the British record on his first attempt.
why are you even saying that as though it's in any doubt? If it doesn't happen, you know what? I'd be tempted to set up all kinds of snares for him along the way. That would be incredible. Especially if we've got a BBR. That's the thing. If we have a BBR aid station, as we do tend to have on a lot of Centurion races, with alcohol and stuff, of course he's not going to touch that alcohol. It's form for him. Of course he's not going to come near it. It'll run straight past that.
Well, what's the film that is, I think, an old Disney, but from the 60s, where they keep on changing the road signs? They're doing all these things to try and stop someone winning a race or getting somewhere. We could do that, potentially create a new path, send him down a different river.
It's the thing about the Thames Path, it's one of those ones that go, it's really easy, you're not next to a river, you're going the wrong way. But there are bits of it that are, you know, because there's so many tributaries and there's so many different crossings and stuff like that, it's really easy to end up, you know, crossing and then running for ages on the wrong side.
And all we need to do is to get him to start. We just need to get him to start in the different direction. Then we'll be fine, because he'll have 100. He'll only find out 100 miles later. We'll set up our own aid stations. We'll do everything as if it's normal.
Yeah, yeah. Or I'll just get if we want to discover it, I'll just get my dad to give him directions there, as per the last Thames Path race.
Good old dad. So I wanted to share a bit of news from good news, because we, not insanely good news, but I just thought it was a nice bit of warmth. I did the marathon of Afghanistan 5 years ago.
Yep.
And this year there was a real risk of it, I guess, it losing its impetus because without internationals being able to go there, which includes the organizers. But yep. I've received a letter, an email from the James Wilcox, who is one of the originators of the race. And it's amazing. They had 615 people do either the marathon or the 10K. They've now got a 1K children's race. But there are a couple of things that I thought were really, really cool about it. Firstly, 2% female, which is insane if you knew what Afghanistan was like in terms of how segregated its society is and how much women are seen as second class citizens. So one, that's amazing. But also there's a story of this guy called Murtada and Ahmed. Now Murtada is 14 and he was the very last person to sign up for the 10K, having waited queuing the previous day. But on the day, he'd always been dreaming of running a marathon, so he just carried on. Partway through, he was given an Afghan flag by a spectator, And he ran the whole way with another runner called Ahmed from Kabul. And this was a Pashtun man helping a Hazari boy complete his dream, holding the national flag, which if you don't know the tribal issues between those two groups, this is a huge, huge moment. So I just thought a lot of information that people might not think about, but such a positive story to come from Afghanistan, and shows you actually that people have a real desire to run, and that they just in the same way that Greg has done, if you drop a kernel of an idea and get people into the sport, they really want to get behind it.
Yeah, that's really important, isn't it? Like not needing that international element there. It's obviously great to have that international element there, but it being able to run without that, because essentially that's the whole, you know, that's the whole point, isn't it? It's putting something there to create a base that they can, on the ground, they can take it in whatever direction that they want to go with it.
Yeah, 100%. And it's going to feel very different to them, I'm sure, even just having the people organizing it be all locals. It very much becomes their event, and they'll take more ownership of that. And I think that would be a positive for future years. And also, it's giving people that chance to actually have that responsibility, so that hopefully they can go on and do other events as well. Yeah. Now, have you seen Strava have raised $110 million?
Have they? Why?
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure. It's interesting because they changed their model so that people paid subscription. Previously, you could do that, but actually you could get most of the benefits of using Strava without having to pay anything. And they've now almost upped the ante, where if you want to get the really good competitive leaderboards and various other functions, you now have to pay £5-6 a month.
Oh, dear. Okay.
But that's, I thought that the price that they put that at was actually a good price, where most people or a lot of people would take them up on that, which to me implied that would generate a huge amount of money for them. So it's really interesting now that they're taking on another funding round. I think it's their seventh funding round, even though they've got all this extra money coming in, which I find a bit worrying, because it implies that they are they're not self-sufficient. And so my worry is that one, these companies, they can keep on raising money on the promise of profitability, but if they're not self-financing at some point, then the money runs dry. So this is just my fear, that will we have Strava in 5 years?
I think it's one of those things, isn't it? It's about proving that there is a market for people to pay that subscription. And that's what leads to another funding round. So then basically getting that funding again, because that's the order in which it's happened. And they kind of like, you know, you're seeing that happen a lot of time now, actually, with a lot of previously like free services, like things like Loom and stuff like that, which were free for ages. Now all of a sudden, you know, they started charging for it and stuff like that. And they're always going to at some point. And, you know, part of it is to do with, you know, the fact that we are in a recession, and, you know, all of a sudden these like venture capitalists and, you know, all this funding and stuff is starting to be squeezed, or they're putting like pressure on them to actually get them to show that there is it don't even have to be profitable. It's to show a pathway to profitability, isn't it? That's the thing. If you think about the stuff that Amazon went through. Like, how long did it take Amazon to be profitable? It was like 15 years or something before they even like made a single product, made a profit of any sort.
But although that was an intentional tax dodge, really, wasn't it?
Well, I don't know if it was necessarily a tax dodge. I think a lot of it was to do with the fact it was such aggressive expansion. That was the thing. Mm. All the money went back into it, sort of expanding everything. I wonder how many, because they went when the kind of like recession kicked in and everything, you know, there's loads of different running apps. There's loads of different sort of like running technology and stuff like that, all which is like funded and stuff like that. And I think we talked about this a few months ago, saying that, you know, how many of those things are going to sort of collapse now? They're going to have the funding withdrawn, or they're not going to get more funding, or whatever. That, is it actually going to see a contraction in the number of apps, or consolidation? What normally happens is, you know, they merge, or one, you know, takes over another, you know, so it can buy the list, so they can expand it, you know, a bit further. So, yeah, I imagine it, we're going to see some kind of consolidation or kind of a partnership. Because it was like, remember, how long ago did Under Armour take over?
My run,
yeah,
my fitness,
that, yeah, all the, yeah, that was a really, because you, I mean, that's just access to data, isn't it, that they were doing that for, but that was, I mean, that was quite a clever move, I think, from that respect.
Yeah,
and I wonder if something similar happened, that, you know, something like Strava is taken over by something else, or they acquire a bunch of other apps in order to, you know, corner the market. I don't know. It seems as though it's coming to a head, really, especially with the amount of activity. But then I don't use Strava, so I don't really care.
But then with Strava, I can't really see it saturating the market much further, because you're probably the only runner I know that isn't on Strava. And also, its functionality hasn't changed dramatically from my personal usage. Everything I've wanted Strava to give me, it's been giving me for 10 years. And sure, it does make small improvements here and there, but it's limited by what data you give it. And until they make a breakthrough in either lactic devices or similar, I can't see what they're building towards with thing. You could see other industries where, say, you've got Uber or you've got WeWork, that, well, not WeWork, but with Uber, there was a theory that keep on growing, conquer, 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 and Uber could have been going towards automated cars, at which point, boom, they don't have to pay anyone, they make a fortune, or just total dominance, at which point they up their prices. But you could see the strategy behind the investment there, whereas Strava, it already does everything you want it to do, and everyone uses it. So what's the change?
Well, you think, what business is Strava in? Are Strava in the app that tracks your running metrics, or are they in a different business? Do they see themselves in a different business? Because if they're in a tracking your running metrics business, then their end game may be something akin to trying to sell you stuff or monetizing it in some way about, you know, some kind of customized nutrition or customized supplementation or something related to those metrics, something where those metrics are going to be useful in some way. But if they see themselves in a different business, if they're in the business of, you know, just aggregating people who like running rather than specifically metrics, then I don't know, it's like you say, maybe it is sort of joint partnerships or something like that. It is really difficult to see what someone like Strava is trying to do. I think that Uber example is a good one, because, yeah, no one, when Uber started out, no one really thought Uber's like grand plan was, you know, unmanned drones flying people from place to place, but that is their direction. So what is the Strava direction?
Yeah, and it is because of the economy, as you say, but also there's been a lot of IPOs that are flopping. You know, the valuation of Uber doesn't continue to grow. WeWork's absolutely tanked. There's been quite a few big companies that reaches a point where companies have to make profitability, and quite a few companies have been shown that they never will. And what happens then? And so there is a bit of a rethinking that previously in tech, it was push money at it, whoever wins then can just print cash, whereas now you might not get to a winning position. And so it'll be interesting to see, as you say, what happens with other tech and whether there are more acquisitions or whether they just go pop.
That begs the question, what's our grand plan? What's our strategy? Are we an aggregator of
misfits? We're just waiting until all the other people give up doing podcasts, and then we're the only one.
I don't know. That's the thing. I thought that was going to happen because what's it called? The average number of episodes a podcaster gets to is 8 or something like that. I think that's the average.
Right.
The fact that we're in a really, really tiny percentage of people that have done more than sort of 250 episodes.
And like Ultra Runners, it's not because we're better. It's just because we're not good that we have to keep on going.
Yeah, that's it. Just like Ultra Runners. Point I was making. Nope. Yeah, but that's the thing. And so we thought, actually, you know, the amount of time that you have to dedicate to it, a lot of people are going to drop off. It's like people doing free yoga at the start of lockdown. Loads of people doing free yoga online. 3 weeks in, pretty much everyone had given up. Like, oh, I'm not doing this free shit anymore. But yeah, the problem is that lockdown, it went to that point where people went, oh, do you know what? I'm really bored. I know what I'll do is I'll launch a podcast. And a whole new plethora of podcasts. I'm not just talking about running. I'm talking about any old Tom, Dick and Harry who has a business thinks, oh, do you know what? People want to listen to my story. They don't. They don't want to listen to your story, but you had to put it out there.
How do you know unless you try? How do you know?
How do you know? How do you know people don't like your story until you get it out there and they reject it? I suppose that's it. It's like saying, like, oh, you know, everyone has a book in them. Everyone's got a podcast in them now.
Yeah, well, I mean, a book takes a lot more work, doesn't it? I don't have a book in me, unless someone wants to narrate. You know, if I narrate and they write it down. But the thing is,
what people have to remember is that, you know, if you are launching a running podcast or something like that, you're contending against the number one running podcast in the UK. Best running podcast of the year. Thanks, Running Awards. I didn't expect is the thing is I don't think it's really hit us, actually, that in some way we are the top running podcast in the UK. It's come about so accidentally.
The reality is with the top ones who've managed to categorize their listing correctly, so therefore get to the top of that chart. I know a lot of podcasts out there bigger than us that we won't mention it to them in case they figure out what to do and then they become the top, but they're in another category still. So I think we've got to be a bit careful about what we say there.
As they say, 90% is showing up. If you show up in the wrong place, then that's if you turn up on the wrong court, yeah, you're going to play basketball against the wrong people.
Yeah, yeah. Great analogy.
That's a shit analogy.
Now, before we go into our guest, linking into it, Greg talks to us about running a trail around the world and bringing it to places around the world. I wanted to mention, have you seen Danny Bent's new run?
No, but I did see a post of yours that went out asking for people from unusual countries.
Yeah, so... Danny, if you don't know Danny, he's been on the podcast, I think, 3 times, maybe even 4 times. He might have the records. And he's a great man who organized the London Relay. His vision was always to put together a world relay. And he was in a similar situation to a lot of people where he finally looked like his dreams coming true. And then COVID happened, lockdown happened. And so he's tried to warp that into something else. His whole vision has always been to try and unite people, and so he's doing this thing called One Run, and the idea is that every country in the world runs on Human Rights Day at 7 p.m. in their local time. So he's trying to get all the countries covered. He's missing quite a few still. I think Iran's
what's he missing?
One.
What's he missing? I think we're number 2 in Iran, number 2 running podcast in Iran.
So do badders, if you know someone who lives in these countries, it's quite a long list, actually. I don't know if we've got time. But if you know someone who lives in these areas, they don't have to be a runner, just someone who is a bit of a legend, that you can either put them in touch with Danny Bent or just say, look at One Run. So it's onerun.global. The countries are Bahamas, Belarus, Chad, Cuba, Democratic Republic of the Congo, Equatorial Guinea, Eritrea, Guinea-Bissau, Iran, Madagascar, Mauritania, Micronesia, Monaco, Namibia, Nauru, North Korea, North Macedonia, however you pronounce that, St. Vincent and the Grenadines, San Marino, Solomon Islands, Sri Lanka, Sudan, Tanzania, Timor-Leste, Togo, Tuvalu, Vanuatu, and Yemen. So if anyone knows people in those countries, whether they run or not, please either message us, letters@badboyrunning.com, or send them to One Run, because they are the last countries on earth that we need to get doing this race. It's on the 10th of December. So Danny is the most wonderful person. So help him out, because it's all for a good cause, and let them know about it. Tempted to do it, JD?
What day is it?
It's the 10th of December.
Yeah, that sounds quite nice.
Cool. So do bad. Sign up as well.
Are you doing it?
I'll do something. I still can't run. So, yeah, do something at 7.
I'll do something at 7, drink.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe I'll look at people running on a video or something like that. But talking about running around the world to someone who has invented running and then brought it to the world, I think it's fair to say. Take it away, Nick. So, Do-Badders, we've got an absolute treat for you today. I've been trying to get Greg on for I'm not sure how many months, and the reason I wanted to get Greg on is for three or four reasons, really. He's an incredible athlete in his own right, in more than one sport. But we're going to ignore that
That would normally disqualify him from coming on. So
we're going to ignore all of that, because his current role is managing the athletes for Solomon. And we wanted to explore what that's like. But also, he's been involved in the role that Solomon has had in bringing sport and trail running in particular to countries where the brand wasn't known, but actually the sport wasn't really known, to really get a sense of how trail running is changing around the world. So welcome on the podcast, the wonderful Greg Vallée. Yay!
thank you.
How are you doing, Greg?
Good. Thank you very much in this particular year and moment with all this COVID, with all the event cancelled, we try to do our best.
Because I know a lot of brands, it's strange COVID in that some brands have done incredibly well, but some brands are really suffering because obviously shops are closed, but then actually more people are running and we can still exercise as much as we did. Like for Solomon, how's it been?
It has been a very, very difficult during the confinement in March, April, May. And then during this confinement, in fact, a lot of people start running. It was a new sport for them. So we have seen a lot of newcomers, new beginners coming to trail. And in fact, when our stores reopened in June and our website, etc., the sales was really good. Of course, we took so much, the gap between ourselves and what we were expecting is so big that we will not be able to catch up until the end of the year. But we are coming close by. So it's not a bad year.
And does it create challenges, the fact that it's a lot of those sales are driven by new customers, because the new runners want different products, and are some shoes selling out and some aren't? And are you finding that actually the product quantities that you'd committed to and ordered are all wrong with your new customers?
In fact, we have seen a big increase of our road running range. And that was a bit of a surprise. And it's a good sign for us, of course, because we we are able now to also answer the needs of people who live in cities.
So do you think it's your existing customers who are being forced to switch to more road running because they can't get out as much? Or do you think that's because the newer customers tend to be people who are just discovering running and therefore more likely to be in a city?
Well, they were forced to stay around their home, run. So they have to run on the road. And also, there is some new people who start sports during the confinement and discover us, you know, our brand, because they were more or less close to outdoor.
So, are you close enough with the, I guess, the marketing department and the communication department within Salomon to get a sense whether are you having to almost change how you're communicating with this customer base? Because we've known Salomon for years. You know, we know the heritage, we know the iterations issues have been from. But obviously, if you're new to running, it might be they've never heard of your company before, and they see you the same as a Brooks, as an Asics, as a Nike.
Yeah, it's true that we are starting a new era for Salomon, where we will invest on road running more than before. That doesn't mean that we will not invest anymore in trail running. Of course, we want to keep this sport, you know, because it's very important for us. It's part of our DNA. But of course, we will push our communication and the marketing department also on road from now.
And are there now different departments, one for trail running and one for road running, where you wear different clothes? You know, trail runners are a little bit cooler.
Road runners leave their rubbish everywhere.
This is a mess. Yeah, that room's full of gels, whereas the other one's for the trail mix.
Well, we have different people who work on the different sports. So we are a little bit in a vertical mode, where we have people working on trail running and people working on road running. But at one point, we have also some transversalities also in terms of communication.
It'll be great in 50 years' time to find out whether they've had to change the, you know, the training of each department, because they're so diverse from each other and yes. You know, so far removed in the products and things they make. But anyway, we're meandering away from one of the main reasons we want to get you on. I mean, when you first joined Salomon, that was it 10 so years ago?
Yeah, a little bit more than 10 years ago now. True. Yeah, it was. I arrived and with a white paper on my table, with a computer empty.
You know. And what was your remit back then?
You know, I was there and they told me, well, your main job will be to develop trail running in the world.
I love the broad nature of that. That's not even regionally or, you know, within Europe or anything like the world.
Yeah. Let's go.
Like 10 years ago, when, you know, I mean, road running, of course, you know, it has massive amounts of popularity, you know, huge mass participation, never been more popular. Especially people getting out into the streets and everything. And so at that time, was it much clearer to define trail running as the thing that's opposed to road running? And so it was a much there was much more sort of scope to do stuff with it, and much more as a clear delineator for the people that either were fed up with road running or were never going to be road runners in the first place.
In fact, we were coming, you know, from adventure racing. Salomon were investing a lot in all these adventure sports. And it was cycling, mountain biking, kayaking, climbing, trail running, and canyoning, and many sports, you know, combined. But in reality, the visibility of Salomon was mostly in trail running, because on the other sports, they were not using Salomon equipment. And it was very difficult with all the logistics for the athletes to organize big events. It was always very challenging. And so we have seen trail running as the answer for us to invest more precisely on one sport and push the visibility of this sport versus a lot of different sports combined. And we started this in 2003.
Back then, yeah. which countries would you say were trail running countries?
In France, we start with France at the beginning, at the very beginning in 2003. And I arrived in the company in 2010. So during these 7 years, it was very local. In fact, each country was working locally to develop the trail running. But when I arrived in the UK, for example, the British Salomon team was already existing. In fact, what was not existing, it was at that time the international team. So this is what I bring on the table. So from 2010, we organize an international team to develop the sports around the world, because that was my main job. So it was for me to put an umbrella above all the countries like France, like Spain, like Italy, like Sweden, who already had a lot of good runners, to bring them, you know, to bring the best ones under an international team and start to travel to most of the famous races around the world. And we started in 2010 with Kilian at the Western State. That was really the start of the international team.
Oh, and how did Kilian do in that first race for you guys?
At the Western State, it was very funny, you know, the month before we leave there, it was crossing the Pyrenees. So it was 800 kilometers in 8 days. It was running around 100K by day with, so it was 800K with 40,000 meters of elevation. Crazy. He finished completely burnt. And 3 weeks after, it was the Western State. So he recovered. We went to the Western. And there, he was not used to run on a flat terrain.
I suppose it is flat, isn't it, to him? Yeah.
He don't like when it's very warm. And he starts just with a small bottle, but no backpack, nothing. He just go and start and run, you know. And it was at that time with Anton Kruprika and Jeff Rose, and they were the three together running in front, and everything was going well. He was joking during, you know, each time we were talking, he was joking, he was jumping, he was happy to be there. And then he starts to go away from the others, take some time. And during a downhill, I was waiting for him, and he arrived with the knees full of blood. I was telling him, what happens? It's the first time I have cramps. You know, it was... because it was so warm, he didn't drink anything. So it was the first time for him that he was having cramps, you know. And so he stopped, in fact, in a river to cool down. And Anton Kruprika passed, but he didn't see Killian, you know, he just passing like this. And then Jeff Rose passed like this, and Killian was still in the water, in the river, cooling down. And Jeff Rose catch up with Anton and say, "Where is Killian? Is it far?" "I don't know. I suppose he's in front, not catching him." And so Jeff Rose run and run. He was going super fast. And that's why he finished with 23 minutes in front of Anton Kuprika.
Wow.
Because he was trying to catch up on Killian, you know, and Killian was just in the water to cool down. So it was really crazy. And so Killian finished with a lot of difficulties this first Western State in third position with plenty of cramps. And the following year, he came back and he won the race. But it was a very nice story.
And he made him wear full kit that time rather than just going out with the bottle.
Yes.
And that first race was, because if that was your first proper outing as a team, was there a lot of pressure on you for Killian to do well?
No, you know, it was really a kind of a test for him because it was really not his playground. Killian is really, as you know now, close to the mountain. But at that time, but even now, he likes, you know, to try to put him in an uncomfortable zone, you know, and to take some risk. And this is why also he likes to go to Ciazinal. Ciazinal is a fast race, not really made for him, but he knows that at this start of the race, there is the most talented runners at the start, fast on the road, on track, and he will fight with them. And he don't know at the start if he will be the winner or not. And this is what excites him to go back to this race every year.
You see, that's the problem JD and I never have, because we always know we're not going to be the winner at the start.
Yeah, I don't think that's ever.
But we never sign up for races.
Yeah.
And so when you were looking at the countries to go after, were you trying to link up the countries that already existed in trail running, or were you also trying to think of which countries potentially could become new markets for us?
Yeah, so from 2011, I start to travel to China every year, almost, sometimes a few times a year, to develop the trail running community over there. The trail running was almost not existing at that time, and we were organizing community event. We were trying to teach the community what is trail running. And I remember it was crazy. The first year we were bringing them to the top of some peaks around their cities. And it was the first time for them to reach the top running in the mud, because for them at that time it was not well seen to run in the mud. They were running only on pavement made by the king. and when we arrived at the summit and they saw the view, the panorama, you know, the landscape, they were just you know, lying, yelling. They were yelling, some were just like, "Wow!" You know, super exciting. It was very emotional, you know, to just watch them. And then they started to do it every weekend. You know, they were coming back to the summit. And when the following year I was coming back, again, I was meeting the same people telling me, "Yeah, you know, I discovered new peaks everywhere." And the community was growing and growing. And then we start in 2000, 2013, I think, a Salomon Running Academy in China, where in each, it's not a department over there, you know, they have a...
Like a county.
Yeah, kind of. Each county, we were selected a few athletes and bring them to the Salomon Running Academy and try to create the Salomon Team China. And so we create the Salomon Team China from these academies. And then follow every year, we were trying to update the team with this academy. And now there is many races. So when we were there at that time, it was maybe 5 races in the country. And every year, it was the double. Each time I was coming back, it was 10, 20, 40, 80. And now it's crazy.
And going back,
when you were working with like creating those communities, what were you working with existing running clubs in order to develop that, or were you having to start from scratch in some places? I mean, how well developed was running as a sort of a club activity?
In fact, we were not using running clubs. We were using the social media from there. So yeah. Weibo, WeChat, and all the people who were in touch with Salomon. Already, we were trying to invite them to some meetings, to some conferences, to some runs, etc. And we start at the beginning like this from social media. And then it grows a lot by the word of mouth.
And do you think that expectation of not getting your shoes dirty, is that something that was kind of culturally ingrained within the Chinese psyche?
Culture.
Or was that something that actually they just hadn't thought to get? Because it's not an instinct that makes a lot of sense with clothes, is it? Why didn't I ruin my clothes?
But, I don't know. My mum was always very clear about me getting my shoes dirty when I was young. So I think it's a Chinese cultural thing.
No, in fact, it was more cultural. Just that when you have dirty shoes, it means that you are a farmer. So that's why they were not used to run in the mud.
And did you find resistance at the beginning? And do you still find resistance now? That did some people find the mud and just decide no?
No, not at all. It was really funny to see them how much they were excited to do something new for them and very accessible as well. I was in South Korea as well a few times, and I have met some runners over there, super excited, but yelling even when they were running, you know, like, yoo-hoo, where's he? And we found there a different spirit in China and another different one in South Korea. So, for example, in China, most of the runners, when they start for the first time, they want to do a competition, they register for 100 kilometers. Their first competition. I will do a 100K. And we try to tell them, yes, but you know, it's very long. You need to start slowly with a 20K and then a 40, and then you will see. I want to start with 100. This is my dream. I will do it now. Okay, but everybody in China are just going straight away to the ultra. No matter what.
And are they finishing it?
Yeah. They will take their time, but they finished. It's unbelievable.
Wow.
And in South Korea, We've done also a Salomon Running Academy, and we told them that at the very end, we organize a kind of a private race, you know, between the academies to define who will be the winner and who will be part of the Salomon team, South Korea, and invite team on some races, etc. And I remember I was there with Dakota Jones. We were running in the first group with them, and nobody was attacking. No, and was already 20 kilometers, and they are still running all in a group at the same pace.
I thought you were going to say a straight line there.
So I asked Dakota, don't you want to attack a little bit and see if people will follow you? Okay, so Dakota just attacked. And he attacked and nobody moved. Dakota was going away alone.
Wow.
And nobody moved. They were just running at their pace. So Dakota stopped, wait, say, not coming, I'm alone in the front, so I will stay with you. I think, we leave, we will attack together. Maybe they will follow us. So we attack together. Nobody moved, they were just all together. And in fact, we were talking with them and telling them, why don't you attack? We are at 5K from the finish now. And they say, no, we want to stay together. No, but we don't need to create a competition between us. We are good now like this, and we want to stay like this. And, finishing together, it will be a beautiful story. And, it was crazy because we were pushing them, to define who will be the winner of a big gift. And all of them were like, no, but we prefer to stay all together.
which is so lovely, right?
And yes, and it shows, a different spirit again. And this is what I learned a lot from different countries, is that the emotions are the same in the sports everywhere in the world, but the spirit is different.
So if we want to win a race, we should go to South Korea.
Yes!
Talking about the cultural aspect of it, have there been any territories where you either try to go into where there's been a cultural issue which meant that it hasn't been able to take hold, or it's taken longer to take hold, or anything like that?
No, I've not seen any issues because each time we are talking to passionate people. In fact, we are very lucky to practice a sport where people have a lot of emotions also outside of competition, just between friends. And so people get passionate about it very easily. You don't need to have a Killian's level to have big emotions. You can just hike to the top of a mountain and you will have the same emotion than Killian, even though you will put it three times his time, But at the end, when you will arrive at this peak, Killian will take a picture. And you will take exactly the same picture just because it's the same emotion at the end, no matter the time you put to go to the top. And, this is what we met everywhere in the world. That's why when we were in South Africa or in Argentina or in Australia or in China or in the US, everywhere, the emotions are the same. It's just the spirit. Yeah.
And do you get the sense that you're converting people from other sports to trail running, or are you unlocking sports in people, do you think?
No, it's true that we have seen a lot of athletes coming from Nordic skiing, mountain biking, cycling, road running, mud race, whether it's ski mountaineering. We have seen a lot of athletes coming from orienteering, a lot of orienteers coming to trail running. Yes, no, it's funny because I guess it answers a lot of needs from many people. For some, it's just to train because they are more they have more a winter season. But for some others, it's also a good training for their main sports or just to make an alternative to do something else. And for those coming from a mountain bike, for example, it's a little bit the same spirit. It's just that you can practice it without doing loops. You know, in mountain bike, you are often turning around and there is no more exploration, improvisation. This is what you can do in trail running that it was possible 30 years ago in mountain bike.
And do you get a sense of the type of person who are the pioneers in the new countries? Are they a particular class? Do they tend to be more working class, more middle class? Are they people that are already the type of people that are taking on crazy adventures?
We have seen people from every level, really. Some of them were coming from athletic school in China, for example. They were coming from marathon school. You know, they are in a kind of national club, and they are trained by the government to prepare the Olympics game. So on marathon, and every year, if you are not in the right time, you are fired of this club. And if it's few years that you are training in this club, from a day to another, from a year to another, you lose your job. And so we are seeing now more and more road marathoners coming from China moving to trail running, because in China some organizers are putting prize money. And it's the each canton, the tourism offices of each canton, who is putting the money to attract strangers. And so if they are able to show that there is, 10 different nationalities that are coming to their race, then the following year they will have more money from the tourism offices. And so they are developing... Okay. They are developing the trail running because of the tourism offices in China now. So the organizer, before, they were working on adventure racing, and now they are switching to trail running to attract people from all over the world to visit their content. So it's a way to create running touristic.
Because one of the issues you have is that you're going into like somewhere like China and you're developing trail running as a sport at that level. But how you're making sure that there are actually enough races for people to do and things to focus on? There must be doing some work in one area and actually then helping people either organise it or through sponsorship of races or promotion of races in order to try and actually make sure that there are enough big enough races to keep that momentum going for the community.
Yeah, so since the beginning, I'm working at this position, was very clear. So it means that trail running was a sport big like this at the beginning, and now the sport is big like this, right? So when it was big like this, Salomon had 30% maybe of the market, and now it's still 30%. So what does it mean? It means that what is important is to grow the pie, you know. And to grow this pie, it's to work also with the other brand, because we are not fighting to have a bigger slice. We are fighting to have a bigger pie.
Yeah.
It means that each brand can have a bigger slice without fighting each other.
Mm. But have you seen some countries where you've been in and started to encourage trail running, and then you've found that there just aren't enough local people who are actually prepared to start races in their region, and so you're left with frustrated runners with nothing to train for?
No, we have a event everywhere in the world, because we have subsidiaries in many, many different countries. We have a national team, and we have national events. If I take China, for example, we have Ultra Trail Nihai, Ultra Trail Saigu, Gaoligong, and many more races that are sponsored by Salomon. And we have Miao Yao, Minchi, you know, those good runners that are competing also at international level. So I mean that when I was talking about the brands, it's just because we are just one part of this world. And all brands together, we are all together working on the trail running development much more than the federations, because it's the brands that are paying the athletes. It's the brand that are paying the organizer. So it's with all the brands that we're able to create a huge terrain of playground for the trail runners, you know. So it's very important that OCA, TNF, La Sportiva, and all the others invest also on athletes, on events, on image, in communication, to continue to grow the pie all together, you know. And this is true in every country, because we have all subsidiaries everywhere. So it's true that there is some countries that are more lucky than some others, because the market, it's the business, it's much more interesting in some countries, like USA, for example, like France, Germany, UK, and a big potential in China. So those markets are, of course, kind of a priority for all the brands. But we know that the community is way broader than that. And that's why we will create some big partnership with, for example, the Ultra Trail Cape Town in South Africa, because it's a race who will resonate all over the world. This is why we picked Mirarai in Nepal. We don't have any store in Nepal. We don't sell anything over there. But Mirarai resonates all over the world. So this is also to take care of the global community.
And when you go into a new market, or you meet people like Mira, how do you assess kind of who you're actually going to support as a company, and what criteria do they then have to meet kind of on a continued basis?
So I try to follow the athletes for at least a few months, 1 year, before to, well, I start to talk with them, you know, start to know them a little bit more, their spirit, if their values will fit well with our brand, but also with our team, because we are developing a family. So it's important that in our trail running team, our family, everybody is super happy to meet each other, to train together, to live together, because we are renting homes, houses. We are not going in a hotel with different rooms. No, we are, you know, creating this kind of family to have a close relation, you know, a friendship. And this is very important, to choose people who will fit well in this group first. Then we will see...
And what would you say are the characteristics for that?
Well, you must be social. You know, if you are very individual, you have difficulties, if you are very shy, but it's we select already some shy people. It was okay, but you need then to have some people that are a little bit extravagant to compensate, you know, to create the atmospheres in the team. If someone is shy and don't talk, it's not really a problem until there is a good atmosphere in the team. But if the people is very individual, don't want to train with the others, they want to train alone, they want to do everything alone, it will be difficult to work as a team together. You know, sometimes I ask the athletes to work as a team during a race as well. And this is not always easy to accept.
So what kind of changes would you require an athlete to make in a race then that would suit the team more than the individual? Would it be about, say you had two runners at the front, would you just say help each other to come first and second rather than like attacking each other from the start? What kind of instructions would people have in their mind that they might intuitively as an individual want to break?
So I will tell you a story about the San Francisco race, for example. So the strategy was to, you know, this race is very fast in the Marin County. It's quite far from what our athletes are used to in the mountain, and the Americans are often faster on flat races than the European. And so we were thinking, okay, we will launch two athletes from the start because it's a 50 miles race. And the other athletes will know the strategy. So they were going at a good pace, but not too fast. So the two Salomon athletes was going away. And all the other athletes from the other brand, most of the Americans, was, you know, watching around and following the two Salomon guys, you know. So it was planned that after 40K, the two Salomon guys dropped the race because their race was just 40K for them. And when they dropped, all the others was just like, why are they dropping, you know? but they were running.
They should have hidden in a lake like Killian.
It's a classic Salomon tactic now.
Yeah, you know, they were running the marathon distance in 2:40, something like that. Way too fast for a 50 miles. And our athletes were 10 minutes behind, you know, waiting. And when after the half race, then all the group of the front group was very tired because of this first 40K. And so our Salomon athletes were able to catch up, pass and win.
No. And And because I personally love that. I think there needs to be more of that in racing.
You do love that. That's classic.
I love strategy. Yeah, I love tactics. But how, for example, in that situation, how did you communicate and did you come to that decision? Were people who are members of the Salomon team, would they almost have that expectation that it's about the brand first? Or did some of the athletes already acknowledge they probably weren't going to win it, but they were better on the, like, how did you come to that decision collectively?
In fact, we are talking before to travel there with the ones who will be part of the strategy. It means that they are coming knowing that they will drop the race, for example. But it will be a super good training because their main objective for them is not that race. It's another one. So they are coming to train, and it's a very good training.
But they don't, the rest of the field don't know that they're training. They think they're competing.
No, of course, of course. And sometimes they are going to the victory.
But even if they tell everyone they're just on a training run, that's even more annoying if they're there doing 240 pace going, oh, it's just a training run for me. I'm not even, you know, this isn't my, I wouldn't do this in a race. You know, that'd be crazy. That gets in people's head even more. And have you therefore, because when you have your interviews, per se, of bringing people onto the team, is that something that you, it's almost like, when you're in a relationship with someone and saying, oh, by the way, I'm polyamorous. You know, you got to slip that in before you start the relationship. So before people join the team, is there a conversation about this is how we operate as a team that's different to other brands? Or do people just pick it up week by week as they see their friends make sacrifices for the team?
No, but it's not sacrifices. As I said, it's a training for them because their main objective is another race. Mm. And the guys who will do his main objective during that day, maybe he will come on another race to train and help the guy who was training at his race. You know, it's just like a combination. So there is no sacrifice. There is just good training.
And have you had any instances where individuals haven't towed the line, or they've looked as if they are going to tow the line and then just thought, I was thinking of retiring next year anyway, I'm going for the win?
There is some athletes who was training and won the race because they felt super good and they continue until the end. You know, and nobody were able to catch them. So, yeah, after, you know, it's just a matter of feelings and if they want to stop or not, because after, at the end, they do what they want. Huh? I not put a gun on their head. I just make a proposition. Or you stay to train at home, or you come with us in San Francisco to train, whether you choose. Mm. Yeah. Well, okay, I will come to San Francisco. It'd be nice.
I suppose what you're getting at there, Dave, is that for a lot of those runners, they're used to winning things. They're used to winning things all the time. And so if it's their first time being in a team, like asking them to do something that's against that instinct must come as a shock to some of them. Either they don't realize that's what a team's about, or, you know, being in a team is different from what have you bumped up against that?
We don't do that often. We have done that by the past on few races.
Yeah.
We are not doing it often. But after, I guess we are maybe the only one moment to do this kind of stuff, because it's more a kind of cycling strategy, you know. This is from where I'm coming, so I always see a team as a strength more than individuals. you know.
And did you get, when you do something like that, do you get a kickback from the other athletes? Because I can imagine a lot of people would be extremely annoyed at that tactic, because they'd see it's trail running seen, and running is seen as an individual affair. And actually the fact that you've used tactics to your advantage, I think is the best thing ever. But if I'd have lost a race because of my pig-headedness against that, I'd be pretty pissed off. And I can imagine, particularly going into somewhere like America with a European team at a time when Salomon Brand was probably more tied to being European in people's perspective in the States than ever. You know, that's quite a risky strategy, but I could imagine also a lot of people saying, these bloody Europeans coming over here and using all these underhanded tactics to beat our homegrown boys. Did you get a kickback about it?
Yes. I remember Mike Wolf, was coming to me at the end of the race of San Francisco, telling me, well, you really put a mess in our race today, you know. and when we made an interview of him for a video, he said that I was thinking I was during the Tour de France, you know, there were people were attacking and we were just catching up, and then people from behind coming back and attacking, and we were not understanding anything about what was happening, you know, at that time. And he said, it's just after the finish line that we all realize what happened. And he said, that was crazy, you know.
The next year, you should have all turned up in yellow jerseys.
Yeah.
And you know, go ahead, Greg.
No, you were talking about yellow jerseys. It's just that we will have next week, in 2 weeks, the Golden Trail Championship. And we put the best climber, the best sprinter, the best downhiller, and the leader of the race with different colors for the bib. So as you can see, we are very inspired by the cycling world and what is working as well.
And just out of interest, with the best sprinter, is that given to the person coming into the race who's got the fastest short distance time, or is there a section within the series on each race where there's a time trial?
So in fact, it's a stage race of 4 days, right? And on each stage, you will have a segment. So for the sprint, it's a segment between 1 to 2 kilometers, but it could be anywhere on the trail, on the course. So the first day, for example, the stage is a 30 kilometers stage, and the sprint is after 25 kilometers. So you need to be fresh enough after 25K to run very fast, 1.6 kilometers.
And were you finding that there were quite a few races going into the series with the intention purely of winning that top?
Yes. We have some track and field athletes which are coming just for the sprint.
Mo Farah's finally got relevance again. He can finally win something. He can stop pacing everyone.
No, but we have people from the Spanish national team on track and field on 3,000 meters.
Wow! Okay.
Coming just to for the sprint. We have Rémi Bonnet who want to do just the climbs. Some Théo Détienne, a French guy who want to do the downhill. There is many athletes who knows they will have difficulties be in front on the overall ranking, and so they are focusing on the segment. And this is super interesting. I think it will be super fun to follow, because we will have a lot of different stories on one stage.
And next year, can you change it slightly so that there's a multicolored top for the guy that parties the hardiest every night? Because I'm signing up and I'm committing to finishing it, but getting that top as well.
It was supposed to be this year, but with the COVID, we cancelled.
What were you about to start?
I was going to go off on a complete tangent, so you jump in.
Oh, I was going to go off on a complete tangent as well, although it was slightly linked. I think we've talked there about Salomon values and the fact that it's inclusive and it's a team thing. And you've also talked about negativity towards, you know, Salomon tactics. I think we need to talk about Salomon man. It's the perfect moment to talk about this. I don't understand whether Salomon man is just a UK thing or whether there is such a thing in other places. Is that a thing in other places?
So what are you talking about? What do you mean?
This is going to get downhill faster than Killian, Greg, by the way.
So Salomon man, I don't know, how would you define Salomon man, David?
Salomon man is someone who at a UK Ultra turns up with brand new kit,
full
kit, and has everything top to bottom in Salomon, has never run before, or all they do is talk about
and then headphones in, doesn't talk to anyone during the race. The complete opposite of being, you know, like a completely individual, not thinking, like has never run an ultra before, basically. That's Salomon man and it's kind of a well-known term and people try to avoid it. And I just wonder, like, have it been associated with that? I mean, it's good that someone's come along and bought all your kit, but being associated with that, that's very sort of against the brand as well.
Yeah, have you heard of that term before as a phrase?
No, that's why I was asking.
I wondered whether there was a version of it in other country, whether there, you know, the...
No, it's true that we are able to see people wearing all the Salomon stuff, but... For us, it's a kind of a success if we can see this kind of people, related to the brand and somewhere influenced by our athletes, by our communication maybe. But if we can see this kind of people somewhere, I could say that it's maybe we have done a good job, you know.
It's true, but in the same ways, when vegetarians find out that Hitler was a vegetarian, they're like, really? We want to be associated with that guy? Isn't there a little bit of, we want to be the cool kids. We want to be hanging out with the kind of surfer runners, the ultra runners.
You know, we are on a market to reach everybody, to reach the full community, no matter the color of the people, no matter the distance they are running, no matter the terrain they are running. It could be flat terrain, it could be very technical, it could be anywhere in the world where it's very humid, where it's very cold, where it's very dry. Salomon has to be everywhere to answer the needs of everybody. So for us, you know, we can just try to answer, all the consumer needs. And if this guy loves to be a brand lover, you know, for us, it's a good advocate.
And actually, it's a massive compliment because that person is the type of person that just buys all of the kit that they think is most associated with trail running. And so there's a reason why they're not Nike man. They're not they probably would be in other sports, but for trail running, Salomon man exists because I guess you guys have been the most successful with being associated with trail.
But for us, you know, it shows a kind of a success story that we have since many years now.
So you don't have a picture of Salomon Mann up in your corporate headquarters, like a cardboard cutout in every room.
This guy is worth so much to us. We need more of this guy.
He used to be a cycling accountant, but he's now switched. We've won him over. But I wanted to go back to when we were talking about international athletes and sponsorships, because we interviewed Mira a few weeks back. But I'd imagine before this comes out, that will come out as an episode as well. And, you know, you've been incredibly supportive of her. When you take someone from a country that is very poor and you give them this massive opportunity, like, how do you ensure that you do it responsibly so that people aren't suddenly, spat out at the other end? And how do you make sure that, because it could, I can imagine it's incredibly hard if someone were to suddenly become an ambassador and have all these opportunities and then to have that door slammed in their face. So how do you balance that?
So I will take the case of Mira, right? Mm. So at the beginning, Mira, she was, starting to win a race in Hong Kong, and this is where I heard about Mira for the first time. I talked with he's not a coach, he's more someone who Richard Bull is from the UK actually.
Oh yeah, he does the 7 in 7, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's taking care of he was living in Kathmandu, and he was taking care a lot of the Nepalese community. So I was in touch with him, and I knew that Mira, that Richard was there to, always take care of her, because she was not speaking English at the beginning. So it was very difficult to talk with her. And when we were talking together, she was smiling all the time, telling yes, 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 yes. Even if she was not understanding anything at all, she was just saying yes, yes, yes. And then she was not doing what we were asking for because she was not understanding. But it was very funny. When we met Mira, she was very poor, coming from her small village, 6 houses, parents, farmers. We invite her to do some races. I was coaching her to train, was taking care of her plan. And she was able to win the 90 kilometers of Chamonix. The first year she was with us. And I remember at the end of the year, she won 5,000 euro of bonus. She came back to Nepal and she buy a land and she buy 100 chicken. And she give jobs to her family, to her brothers, her sisters, to take care of the chicken. The following year, I was asking, hey, how many chicken now? 600 chicken now. Hey, that's the, I'm running for my chickens. And her goal was to reach the 1,000 chicken, So, as you can see, we were not able just to bring her on races, but we were able to elevate her to create a kind of a small company for her family. And now she is also invited very often by the government. She has a real role in the feminine female fight, in the Nepalese community, right? And she is developing her image as the brand in Nepal now, and she's creating a school of trail running, and she have a, she's managing a group of girls, and she's traveling with them from a race to another one. So at the very beginning, it's always just an opportunity that we give, and then some athletes will react with a plan. So we try to build this plan with them and to see how we can work on a long-term vision with them to build something. And some other people will have a lot of difficulties to have a vision, and they will be in their race, in their training, in their performance, but they will have difficulties to see behind. And it's with this kind of people that it's the most difficult to work, because it's more difficult to create something with them.
And would they be paid salaries, or is the sponsorship just flight, entry and kits?
No, for all the international team, they receive financial support in addition of the travels and in addition of the equipment, of course.
What happens then when people get injured? Say someone were to get a long-term injury or to suddenly not be able to race. Are there set rules on what happens to individuals in those cases?
Well, we have seen it already a few times in the team. Of course, it's normal because trail running is very,
it's quite extreme, isn't it?
You receive a lot of shocks, so you can be injured quite quickly. So we have, for example, Ida Nielsen. It's already almost 2 years that she is not able to run because she is injured. But we will not. We have never stopped any contract with any athletes if they were injured, and even if an athlete were pregnant. So, for example, Emily had a baby, and so of course, since 2 years, she didn't compete. But for us, there is not only the competition and the performance. There is also all the social media work that they can do, promote our brand as well. And I remember with Anna Frost, when she was injured during 1.5 year, I proposed her to come here in Annecy and to work and to develop a full range of apparel. And she designed it here. She was working for 6 months here in our office. And she developed a beautiful range with all the New Zealand design, you know, the leaves of New Zealand everywhere on the garment. And it was certainly for me the most beautiful range that we've done for the woman.
And talking about social media, how much of that is there a set expectation on your athletes, and how much of the voice that they put out is them kind of being authentic and them and you coaching them to put content out?
So we are pushing them to work on social media, because when you were in the 90s, performing was enough. No, you were training, winning, answering interviews from journalists, and the job was done. Today is different. If you want to be a professional athlete, you need to be performant, but you need to be performant as well on social media, because you develop your own brand. For example, if you take if you have an athlete with 200,000 followers, this athlete will be very interesting for all the brands. So we are trying to help them to grow, and that's why we are often creating some content that we are posting on the Salomon Running channels, but tagging them to, you know, transfers as well some followers to them and to help them to grow, because more they will grow and more they will be interesting for any brand. We are not growing our athletes of course, most of them are staying with us during 10 years. They are not leaving the team because they feel good here. But it's also good for them if they want to increase their salary or anything, to have this big image on the social media, to be able to see, to meet another brand and say, are you interesting? Look, I have 200,000 followers. The other brand, you know, will not say no easily because it's a big influencer.
And have you had many athletes who have, because I guess the main competitors would be Innovate. Have you had any that have switched teams or that would you look to coax people across yourself?
So that people are actually in another team and that I would like to recruit?
Yes, or the other way around, yeah.
So we have, we had in the past, for example, Oli, Paige from the UK, who was with us and moved after to Adidas. Or Julien Chaurier, who moved to Oka, or, you know, but it's normal. And there is also some athletes like Miao Yao or Minchi, who were TNF, and now they are Salomon. You know, it's the market that is moving from a year to another. But since the beginning, we are working with our Salomon Running Academies. We are nurturing athletes since they are really young. I would like to give you the example of Davide Manini that we met and we start at the Salomon Running Academies to work with him at 16 years old, or Rémi Bonnet at 18 years old, or Lucy Bartolomeu. She was also 18 when we met her, you know, and like Yann Marguerite and more, you know, we try to work with them and to help them to grow. And for some of them, they stay with us for more than 10 years.
And do
so
you,
it's a nice adventure.
Yeah. And if someone does leave, do you find that hard personally? Because do you feel like that's a personal rejection as much as it is the company?
No, because we are talking and sometimes I telling them, because we are talking about the contract, and sometimes I tell them, you should go, because I won't be able to offer you the same. So go. And we are meeting on all the races, and we are still friends, like Ingvild Kaspersen, for example, you know, from Norway, who was in the team as well. You know, we cannot keep everyone in our team, so it's normal to have this kind of movement, but we are still friends, and that's the most important at the end, I think.
And you mentioned the trail series earlier. Are Salomon almost trying to create a world championships series? Is that the intention of it?
No, not a world championship. So we created the Golden Trail World Series. So the intention was really to invite all the best athletes from all the distances. Not all the distances, but on all the short distances, I would say, from every kind of federations, at the same place behind the start line and create a real show, a big show of trail running. This is what we've done, I guess, since 3 years. We have done a live event at Mont Blanc Marathon, for example. We developed new rules, and it worked very well. I believe now we are the reference on short distances. And this year, with the COVID, we adapted to a Golden Trail Championship. So that this is the stage race we discussed earlier. But it brings us also, we learned a lot this year also with the Golden Trail segment that we design all over the world, you know, off-race. We have seen the one of Siadzinal, for example, having more than 3,600 participants. So we have seen that even if the COVID is there next year, there is always a creativity who can bring some new adaptation to the sport.
And has that, because my, when I initially heard of the Gold Trail series, one of my potential worries was that because it was driven by Solomon, it would potentially stop other athletes sponsored by other brands being able to compete. Has that been the case? Because we all really want to see, it would be great to have a trail series of everyone in the world who is right at the top of their game. But I was just worried that that might not be able to happen because of your brand's closeness to the race series.
No, in fact, it was also one of our fear. But no, now we have seen, because we are managing the communication, the image on a very neutral way. And we are doing videos showing all brands. We are showing the story of the race, no matter the brand. And this is something that is very important for us, because if we don't do that, it will not work. So, as you have seen by the past, when Ruth Croft won the series, the following year, she was on the posters, and it, on the general posters, on the teasers, and we were seeing Scott everywhere. But for us, we are just related what happened during this series. We are just a kind of a media at that point.
And say, once we return to normality, if you were to have a couple of years where every podium position was taken by someone who wasn't Solomon, do you think that would change your intentions of doing it again? Like, would that mean that it hasn't worked for you marketing-wise?
So, of course, we have some of the best athletes, and the game is to play, to keep those athletes, but also to grow some new athletes who will replace our best athletes for the future. So we are betting to always have the best athletes, of course. That's the game. But no, we are very happy when there is many brands on our podiums, because it gives also a bigger visibility to all the social media. So no, we are really trying to develop this series. You know, as the biathlon in winter, to try to have a TV live in the future, but maybe we will need the 5G, etc.
Well, thanks so much for coming on the podcast, Greg. It's just amazing to hear.
Yeah, just to finish on the Golden Trail series. One of the, because it's often a question that I have, so I will answer it It's also at the World Championship, you know, we are not sending the Salomon athletes because they are wearing outfit sponsored of the national teams. So it will be mainly Nike, Adidas, and Asics. And we are paying our athletes all year long. It's not to wear an Adidas outfit and to win the World Championship. This is, for us, something that is not fair. And we prefer to invest on a private series where we are fully respected all the brands. And we believe that until the World Championship will be completely locked by these three brands, without any opportunity to have a visibility for all the brands, we will not send our athletes.
And actually, I didn't even know that was a rule of the World Championships. They're my ignorance on that.
Yeah,
but yeah, that
that makes sense.
And it doesn't surprise me about Nike or Adidas to do that, because that's kind of how they roll, right? Well, Greg, thanks so much for coming to the podcast. It's been absolutely amazing. We haven't, it sounds like we haven't got time for questions, but
Hopefully, I have a meeting and I need to leave.
Yeah, of course.
I would love to continue this, of course, and to answer many questions, but time is running.
And if people want to kind of reach out to you and follow your journey, is it better they just go through the Salomon Instagram, or are there ways in which people can stay in touch without you being inundated with applications?
Yeah, of course they can. They can follow the team on Salomon Running, and if they want to follow me, I have also an Instagram profile where I'm very dedicated to the downhill running. So this is something a little bit new, and it's on my page. So Greg Vollet, you will find it.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Greg, and all the best with looking after the athletes and getting to those World Championships in your kit in the future.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Ah, I like that. It's that little sort of bombshell thrown in the last minute there. Just so you go, by the way, we'll never do the World Championships because it's completely closed out by the bastards Nike and Adidas.
Yeah. It's not us being the dicks. It's those guys.
Yeah.
He was pretty candid. He's pretty open about stuff. I love that.
That was great. I was so glad that he told that story about the San Francisco race. That's great. That's really good. But it's really interesting, isn't it? Because I was thinking about the Salomon Man question. And I was because you have to ask it, don't you? Like, you've got to ask it to Salomon. Are they aware of it? And obviously they're not aware that it's a thing, which is quite surprising. Because like that is, I mean, it obviously is a really good endorsement of the fact that someone who thinks that they need to be a trail runner, ultra runner, needs to go full kit in Salomon. That's brilliant. But the Salomon Man is the total opposite of the values that they talk about so much, don't they? But it's
there's going to be someone on trail listening to this dressed as Salomon Man who's going to hear about it for the first time on the podcast and look down at themselves and be like, it's me.
No, they won't. They go, I don't know anyone like that at all.
It's you. But it could be because Greg's removed from the UK market to a certain extent.
That's why I wondered whether it was a phenomenon that was all around Europe or something, or whether it was just a UK thing, or whether other territories have their equivalent of a Salomon. It might not even be a Salomon Man in other countries.
Yeah.
Someone always turns up. They might be, you know, Sportiva Dad, or, you know. And so there's got to be a version of it in every single country. Like, it's all, you know, the people are always like full kit.
I mean, that's a question for the listeners. Do badders email us letters at Bad Boy Running? Does Salomon Man exist in your country? And if not, do you understand what we were describing, and how would you describe that in your local country? You know, there's the obvious one of all the gear, no idea, but is it linked to products and to brands?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But I think there's some really interesting stuff there around growing the market, like having that idea of actually working with other brands to grow the market, especially grow that. I wonder when that switches over to turning into competition, because growing the market in the UK, France, Germany, all of those sort of nations where it's very much established and they have retail outlets, I wonder if you get onto the sales team in those different countries, they'll be like, we're doing what exactly? We're growing what? Whereas it makes perfect
we
sense.
Want the whole pie. We don't care everything. About the slice of the pie. I'm still hungry.
I know, right? So, yeah, but certainly in those countries like China and, sort of South Africa and South America and stuff like that, yeah, absolutely, working together to do that.
And the fact that you forget that I think in the UK we're so used to associations, and we have the tennis association who are there to do grassroots tennis, and the FA, the football association, who are, encouraging women into sport. And actually we forget that associations only really exist once the sport has become big enough through someone else's hard work to require an association.
And they normally, and I'm not saying this is a general rule because I don't know about associations other sports, but in a lot of cases, it's what the associations seem to cream off a lot of cash for not doing a hell of a lot. And I'm not talking specifically about England Athletics here and the bad boy running.
I've heard North Korea is full of associations.
Yeah, I know. It's funny, isn't it? How it requires other people to develop it, and then all of a sudden these associations develop, and they go, "Oh yeah, we're
give us your money, sponsors.
We're raising all this money to support grassroots." And you're like, "Well, but you there? Wait a minute! Like, the grassroots building, it came from the grassroots in the first place before you had an association. So it turns into this weirdly sort.
They're
of
not the seeds; they're the lawnmowers.
The lawnmowers. We will dig this earth up and salt it so nothing grows."
Yeah, and it must have been such a cool job to have, going into China and taking people for runs for the first time up hills. And
but the thing is, it sounds like he had the job that has affected trail running globally. To have that remit of grow trail running globally, that is just such a massive idea. It's such a massive remit. If he'd have been one of these. Kind of 9-to-5ers who gone, I don't fancy it.
I went to China and they were like, "Do you want to get our shoes muddy?" So I went, sorry.
So off I went. Okay. And that's it. Yeah. We could, 10 years down the line, we could have had trail running just in the UK and Germany and not anywhere
else,
because it was solely down to him doing his job.
And actually in 20 years time, the way UTMB looks is probably going to be more to do with Greg's initiative there than anything else. Because already we're seeing, the last 2 years we've seen Chinese runners take off at an insane speed, and they haven't been able to quite hold on to it. But we've had, podiums now from China. And so soon it could be that actually we start to see the current community of trail running being more dominated by China than anywhere else.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing I thought was really interesting you were saying, which I could totally see that people that are just getting into trail running straight away want to do bang 100 kilometers.
Yeah, that's so cool.
But it's so
we've got close to 5k.
you see it here as well. You see people that have barely done any running going, boom, I'm going to do an ultra first race, I want to do 50 miles. Boom. But a lot of that is to do with social media. It's the same impulse that makes someone do a tough mudder makes someone want to do a 50 miler.
Because they're bypassing all the no-sayers and the naysayers in running clubs and in associations and amongst their friends and their peers. And they're just seeing photos of people that look like them doing these races and loving it.
Yeah, and they can do that. The thing is about those races, unless there's a really, really sharp cutoff, you can... Mm. Listen to us. Like,
A couple of weeks ago, a couple of weeks ago, we were suggesting you can run marathons, you know, on no training, on zero training, like just someone comes around and gives you 24 hours. And now we're saying you could just do 100Ks, you know, without any training at all.
Yeah, just look around at yourself, you sad, pathetic loser. Yeah, we're talking to you.
If you haven't run 100K as your first race, you have lost.
Unless you've gone further. to be honest, that's what the Marathon Disciple is there. First race, isn't it? For a lot of people. Yeah, but I just love the fact that it actually takes bringing in new people without expectations to change our expectations of what should be normal.
Yeah. And that's it. That ignorance, that complete ignorance as to what, you know, what it is that you should be doing, or you should step up. The only reason that people think you should step up, you should do a 5K and a half marathon and a full marathon before you do anything that, it's just, like you say, that's completely come from running clubs and the way that it's been talked about for, you know, 20, 30 years. That's always been the advice. And now you've got, you know, ultras on a level and with a sort of a level of popularity coupled with social media. And people are like, yeah, I don't want to do all that 5K bullshit, getting a really good, you know, half marathon time before I step up or anything else like that. I just want to go for the big one right away.
Yeah, absolutely. And I hopefully that's going to change in years to come. And
of course, there are no 100Ks and stuff like that to do because of COVID. So it's all academic. You can talk about it as much as you want on social media as well. It's almost as though you've done.
Yeah, one. Which is what we're best at. Is all the talk, none of the trousers, as they say. Well, if you liked that episode, we've mentioned Mira already. She was out a few weeks back where she talked about her journey into trail running, to ultra running. We've had a few great episodes in China. James Paul talked about becoming delirious and thinking he was running across a frozen lake. That's quite funny. We had Alfie, who he went to China and turned into a bit of a celebrity by coming second in his first ultra there. There's any other stories from around the world that would lead on after this you can think of, JD?
The thing that sticks out to me this is that Greg there was giving us really good insight into working with athletes, and I think the Will Ryle episode as well is quite a good compliment for that, talking about working with elite athletes in a different way.
Yeah, Will was working for Runfast, who managed the second tier African athletes to win all of the marathons around Europe that aren't what you know as the Big Six. But also Holly Rush, she set up and managed the ASICS Front Runners team, and she talked about that in addition to her running success. And that's quite interesting in a slightly different way, because, you know, that team is chosen for their social media impact more than they are the results. So they're there, I guess, the next level down to the type of athletes Greg works with them. Wow, I love that. And it's just nice to meet someone from a brand who clearly loves running, and actually to have a brand where they're actually doing good in the world and they're improving our sport and making a better community. And the work as a team to screw people over is the best bit. It's the best bit. But
it was good. The thing is, when he was talking about that, and he was like, it feels underhand, and I was kept thinking, it feels like it's cycling. And then he goes, it's a thing that we got from cycling. I was like, yeah, I bloody knew it. The bloody cyclists, cheating bastards.
Yeah, I mean, but I'd much rather strip the good of cycling to leave them with the hollow shell that they are. Take the good bits. But thanks for listening, guys. If you enjoyed this one, please do leave us a review, because it really helps us. Raises our God, I always run out of words to say at this
profile.
Point.
Profile.
There we go.
Raise our profile and tricks people into thinking we have credibility. That's exactly what we need.
If you haven't left one yet, why not? Just bloody do it. Come on. Doesn't take much. If you want to ask questions to guests in the future, we didn't have time with Greg today, but follow us on Instagram, Bad Boy Running, and we'll then ask your guests directly to them in the interviews.
If you want to join the discussion on Facebook, go to the Bad Boy Running Podcast Facebook group, answer three questions, and we'll let you in. If you want merch, store.badboyrunning.com, and we have a whole range of merch. You can now, for the first time, be a full kit wanker in Bad Boy Running kits.
You can be a Sullivan Bad Boy man.
Sullivan Bad Boy.
Thanks for listening, guys. We'll see you next time.
See you later.
Bye bye.
I must admit I was a clone to be messing around, but that doesn't mean that you have to leave town. Come back, yes, and give me one more try, 'cause a love like this should I never ever die. Come back.
Fuck you, buddy.